Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim are my co-hosts. Gents, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Always good, guys, always good.
Well, never before in the history of the United States has a federal government cut off funding for one of its most exclusive and prime institutions. I am referring, of course, to Harvard University, the beacon of hope when it comes to university education. The prestigious institution has now had a freezing fund of more than $2 billion hours after it rejected a list of demands from the White House. Ozan, take us through what were the demands from the White House and how on earth did we end up here?
You're absolutely right. Who would have thought that Harvard would be leading the resistance? But they seem to be. They seem to be taking a very principled stance against the list of demands that President Trump has put on them, or the Trump administration. And they seem to be the first big university who has actually rejected the demands. Before that, I have heard that other universities such as Columbia, who also was threatened with a freezing of their funds, was effectively they caved in and they avoided this whole freezing thing. But some of these demands effectively center around reforming the governance, ending diversity, equity and inclusion, DEI, which is of course in line with what the Trump administration has done across the government. So ending many of those DEI programs, changing the admissions and hiring, and curbing the power of certain students, faculty, administrators, because of their ideological views, whatever that means. Effectively, it's a political move. You could call it it's another war on, or the next kind of step in the war on the elite. Plays very well to his base. I'm pretty sure that none of the MAGA diehards are sitting there shedding a tear for Harvard missing out on $2 billion worth of funding. In fact, they're on the sideline clapping the administration strips Harvard off its funding. And as I mentioned, these demands have been made on other universities. In fact, it's very similar to some of the, I would say, bullying tactics that have been put on many of the legal firms, many of them have also caved in, particularly legal firms that have been active in bringing about lawsuits against the Trump administration. It is, I would say, and it wouldn't be hyperbolic to suggest that these are the sorts of things that autocrats do. I think there is no doubt that it is very much against many of the constitutional rights. And in fact, Harvard has cited their constitutional rights and their freedom of speech and many other rights that they have under the Constitution in their letter back to the Trump administration, where they've highlighted that they will not abide by many of these demands. So it's something interesting to watch. An interesting sideshow, of course, compared to the main game, which are the tariffs, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah, we'll get to the tariffs for sure. It's not unprecedented from this current White House, which had already pulled $400 million in federal funding from Columbia University and had accused it of failing to fight anti-Semitism and protect Jewish students, which, at the time the Secretary of Education had said that universities must comply with all federal anti-discrimination laws if they're going to receive federal funding. But this one, Rodney, really takes it to another level, doesn't it, with Harvard, of basically saying, do as you're told, otherwise you get no money.
Yeah, I mean, it's a curve on freedom of expression, although the administration cites freedom of expression as one of the things it's trying to protect. It's an autocratic move. It's not any different than tariffs. When we initially had Canada, you must do something for the 1 milligram of fentanyl that crosses the border. You must take some action or we're going to impose tariffs. The truth is these cuts will come anyway. They don't like these institutions. Trump doesn't like these institutions. He's anti-establishment. He doesn't like education in that sense because he's not an educated man. In the academic sense, he doesn't like these people. This is part of something wider. And as Lausanne rightly points out, it's the same tactic with law firms. It's the same tactic now with universities. It's the same tactic with the imposition of tariffs on other governments. So he initially asked them to take some policy decisions, and then he goes on and imposes it anyway. He treats the money like it's his. He doesn't want to give it away to people who don't agree with him. And it's as simple as that. This is, you know, this isn't the end of this process. It's what's next after the universities? What's next after foreign governments? And what's next after law firms? He doesn't like lawyers because they're involved in the process of holding in the account. He doesn't like universities because they're involved in challenging his ideas and pointed out where there's massive holes in them. You know, and he doesn't like foreign governments who don't roll on the floor and say, "Aren't you so amazing?" Or leaders of foreign governments, "Donald, you amazing man. I hear you're really good at golf." It's a mentality thing, and it's toxic and it's autocratic.
I was going to go bankrupt anytime soon because I believe they've got about $53 billion in the bank. However, I think it is very interesting to view it from the perspective of you know, resistance coming from various different parts of society, and a number of law firms, as Rodney also mentioned, have talked about standing up. A number of lawyers have resigned from their law firms that caved in and went along with the demands. So there really is, I think, a level of resistance that's growing. And you can see that from day to day.
And actually, yeah, but the Tesla stuff gave people confidence they could resist, right?
Exactly.
The response to Tesla and Musk and the economic damage done to him is an example of you can, there is collective will in a response, and therefore for institutions or law firms or whatever that stand up and resist Trump, there's going to be other sources of funding will come their way from other beneficiaries and supporters who want them to continue to maintain that type of a position.
And you're seeing results, but also what's happening in the background is significant amounts of I suppose encouragement from, you know, various different political leaders. I think Bernie Sanders and AOC over the weekend did a number of rallies. One was at what's the concert, the big concert, Coachella, they got 20,000 people in Salt Lake City, which I believe is about 10% of the whole population. But 20,000 people, many of whom are obviously young, turned up to the rally over the weekend in Salt Lake City, Utah, which is not really renowned for its progressive politics. But you can see that these people are getting huge crowds, and people are starting to get mobilized and energized. And it only has taken less than 3 months to do that.
Well, as you know, they often say in politics, it's the economy, stupid, right? We've seen the stock markets crash across the world, then recover. There's talks of that this was all one big ploy. Trump made a couple of jokes around some of his rich friends, saying this guy made $900 million, this guy made $70 million. He said that foreign leaders were calling him up and quote kissing his ass to basically exempt them from the blanket tariffs that he had put across many countries, pretty much every country in the world. Of course, he's then backflipped on them. Many countries have gone back to the 10% baseline tariff, except China, where the tariff war is continuing. The US imposed up to 145% on tariffs. Then Trump said smartphones were exempt, but hang on, they're not exempt because other things are going to happen and different. I mean, this roller coaster is incredibly difficult to keep a handle on. It is obviously not pumping certainty into markets, which obviously always want certainty to the extent that it is possible. But what is the implications of this economically, Rodney? There's now talks of a potential recession, which has obviously been on the cards in the US for some time. But does this sort of backflip from Trump change those things? I mean, help us sort of make sense of it all and put it as simply as you can.
No, I mean, in the immediate, it lessens the damage, but it doesn't build confidence because there's no clarity as where the direction is going. I mean, it seems to be that they took the foot off the gas because they were facing immediate catastrophe on a Liz Truss type catastrophe. And, you know, but Trump's thought process is still to keep returning to this again and again. And he sort of cites people having a bit of a wobble, and he was just doing something to sort of reassure them or whatever. The truth is, it was Treasury bonds as the nub of where the concerns started to really come. Every time he goes back to this, it's going to produce a similar challenge and problem, and that's not even factoring in the impact and the immediate impact on cost of living. He's got a group of people around him now, unlike his first administration, who are much more in the believer camp. And what's happening is they're starting to have doubts. So even believers are the ones that are starting to be like some of the direction of travel on tariffs. But it does feel like it's going to come back again and again. And congratulations to Ozan, who rightly called the U-turn, if that's what it is, or temporary pause last week. I was less than 24 hours before it happened. Maybe he's the one doing the insider trading.
But I mean, look, jokes aside, I think, you know, it's just unbelievable that we live in an era where the President of the United States tells you to buy stocks and, you know, a night before he's going to make a major announcement which will have a material impact on the stock market. And this is considered as, oh, it's just Trump, you know. There's no insider trading going on, or there's nothing going on there that's untoward. I mean, you know, if the previous administration had done this, they'd be pulled off onto the town square and hung. I mean, we would never hear the end of it. But this is just one of the crazy stuff that he did last week, including, you know, turning on and off tariffs on an hourly basis. But I have to say, I'm convinced that the damage is done, as are, I think, many people. And you only have to look at the predictions and the projections from, you know, banks like JP Morgan, who've got the probability of a recession at 60%. The billionaire Ray Dalio, who is famous for correctly predicting the 2008 recession and making a hell of a lot of money out of it. But he's convinced that a recession is underway. In fact, he's made comments in the last couple of days that basically say that he's not so much worried about a recession, but something much worse, which is a global depression. And, you know, I'm not sure he's well known for his, kind of historical knowledge, or he's not really a historian, but he says he's read enough history to know that the environment that we're in, the economic environment, the silly tariffs that make no sense, etc., resemble very much a 1930s style America and global economic environment. So, you know, countries like China have revised down their growth to 4%. It looks like major banks in the EU have said that the EU GDP growth, they've forecasted that down. Singapore, of all countries, has forecasted its GDP growth to between 0 and 2% this year. India's central bank has eased monetary policy. You know, all of the indicators are showing, you know, in fact, things like the University of Michigan's consumer sentiment report, which comes out every month, has seen its biggest drop from 57 to 50.8 in terms of the consumer sentiment. To put simply, that's basically the confidence that the consumers have in the economy and what consumers see are going to be, you know, the future over the next 12 months. And that's the biggest fall, I think, since 1981. You know, and then you've got many of the billionaire friends that Trump keeps around him all coming out and blasting his tariffs and what he's done to the stock market. You know, the co-founder of Home Depot, Ken Langone, who's known for being a very, very long-standing Republican campaign donor, is just, he's been on the record and made comments in the media saying that the import duties on Vietnam are bullshit. His words, not mine, but sentiment I absolutely agree with. You know, talking about some of the tariffs on China, which have now reached, I think, 125% at the time of recording. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys, it could have gone up in the last hour. But, you know, he's said that these are too aggressive and too soon. And of course, China has retaliated and said, we're not going to stand for this. We're not going to be bullied, and we're going to increase our tariffs as well to meet those. So you now have a scenario where the two biggest economies in the world are embroiled in the mother of all trade wars. And anything else that happens is a sideshow, because those two economies being in a trade war, even if everybody doesn't have a tariff imposed on them, that trade war will drag the world economy down to the point of a recession. To put simply for our listeners, a recession, the technical term for a recession is two consecutive quarters of negative gross domestic product, so GDP or economic growth. So going backwards effectively for two quarters, that is what the definition of a recession is. This trade war will get us there for sure if the tariffs stick and if Trump doesn't back down, because it doesn't look like President Xi Jinping is going to back down, because the president of China is on a roadshow across Southeast Asia to secure his trade ties and his economic ties with some of the most vibrant and growing economies in the region. So the only winner out, well, actually there is not really any winner, but if the US thinks that China is going to somehow back down and meet the demands of the US in a hurry, I don't think that's going to happen. I think, you know, China has spent the last 4 or 5 years preparing for this. In fact, they copped it when Trump was last in power, and they are ready. They are ready to see it through, and they will, you know, at the end of the day, no one's going to win out of this, but I think China has less to lose than the US, because right now the US is not being run by somebody who has really any plan, any economic or political plan.
Rodney, I want to pick up on something that Ozan said about, well, you know, people just say, but this is Trump. This is what he does. This is who he is. This is sort of how he governs. And, you know, we saw in the last little while, he met with the president of El Salvador and really, you know, said that he would not return a Maryland man who was wrongly deported from the US and sent to an El Salvadorian prison. That is defying a court order. So he's not listening to the federal courts and sort of abiding by those court orders as well. I mean, this has turned from beyond the greatest political theater into somewhat of a scary reality now. How do we, I guess, deal with all of this? I mean, what is the way to keep this power in check? Or has that sort of gone out the window now with where, I guess, the US is heading from an administration and ruling perspective?
I mean, he doesn't care about individuals. He doesn't care about rights. He doesn't really care about right and wrong. I think the fact that a federal court gave a ruling is just like a red rag to a bull with him, because he doesn't respect the judiciary. He doesn't respect intelligent people, but in particular those who disagree with him. He seems to resent them. But the fact that he can have US citizens overseas, but he refuses to seek to bring home because they evidence error on the part of him or his administration, which is in effect what it does, is pretty bad. I mean, it's just not what any leader does. But what I don't see is that there is this critical mass developing off the back of each of these issues, because a lot of the time the base will look at, well, what's this chap's name? Is it Fast Squares? Is it I don't know, another name that they don't necessarily identify with or have some sort of psychological issue with as the status of these people's Americanness in the minds of the base. And I do wonder whether that sort of means that, yes, the usual suspects will protest and complain about this, but it doesn't really go any further in terms of the MAGA thinking populations in some of the other states, less diverse states, maybe one way of putting it. I just think it doesn't cause them that much harm with the base. It's plainly wrong, but I don't see that there's any appetite on his part to change course or to be more careful when it comes to the impact on the individuals. It's no different than Musk, Doge sacking the nuclear experts to rehire them, or the bird flu experts to have to bring them back, etc., etc. It's do this, and then okay, well, we've included a few people in the broader negative aspect of this. It shouldn't be there, but it's only 1%, or it's only 0.1%. The fact that there's 0.1% may be made up of several individuals who've been wronged is basically irrelevant for this administration.
I mean, to me, the more worrying part of all of this is, where does it go, right? Because we're not even 6 months into the Trump administration. In that meeting that I referred to earlier with the El Salvador president in the Oval Office in the White House, where the media were invited in, Secretary of State Marco Rubio referred to the returning of this Maryland man, which the courts obviously intervened him. And he said, "I don't understand what the confusion is. No court in the United States has a right to conduct a foreign policy of the United States. It's that simple, end of story." I mean, that is a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of courts in a democratic society and representative government. The role of courts, of course, is not to implement policy. It is to interpret the current law and then to be able to force a ruling down and act as a check and balance on the executive arm of government, in this case, this particular administration, and the ruling that was done by this administration on this poor man. I mean, that to me, Ozan, is the where does this now go? I mean, we're setting precedent after precedent, week after week, with Trump and the madness that is this White House. You know, God knows where we get to in 3.5 years' time. That's my worry.
Well, you're absolutely right to be worried. I think the American people are hugely worried, because this would be the first time ever, I think, or since Lincoln, that the president has openly defied a court order from the Supreme Court, which is responsible for everything that you talked about in terms of providing checks and balances. And he's done it with a smile on his face. This is the thing that worries me most. And Rodney touched on this. You know, he's not backing down. In fact, he's going further and he's doubling down. And I would encourage anybody who has the time to perhaps just look at some of the footage that's coming out of the meeting that you refer to, Adam, with that autocrat wannabe Nayib Bukele, who's the, you know, current president of El Salvador, who's, you know, basically cosplaying an autocrat. And, you know, he's nothing against El Salvadorians. I don't want to offend them, but he's in charge of effectively a failed state. And, you know, he's the way that they treat Caitlin Collins from CNN, you know, when she's asking questions around some of the things that you mentioned, they're effectively throwing it back at her and saying, "Of course you would ask that. You're from CNN. You're not American. You're not a patriot. You know, you hate the American people. You're nobody watches your channel or network." you know, sure, ratings at CNN have gone down, I'm sure, but at the end of the day, you know, this is he has really taken it one step further, and he is now bullying everybody that asks him any difficult question. And one thing that he actually said to Caitlin Collins in that interview really stuck with me, and that is, you know, why don't you ever commend the things that we do, Caitlin? You're always criticizing about this, about that, etc. And, you know, Caitlin Collins being humiliated in front of everybody, I'm sure wanted to say, well, Mr. President, that's not my job. My job is to hold you to account. But he doesn't believe that. He believes that the media in that room should act like the state regime media, similar to what the North Korean media behaves like in front of their fearless leader. And that's what he believes that the role of the media is. And that's what he is trying to beat into the people that are in that room, and he's bullying them, and he's doing them, and he's doing it in an autocratic way, and he's got next to him this bozo who, you know, as I said, an autocrat wannabe president of El Salvador, sitting there smiling and having a crack at the US media. I mean, it's unheard of. Like, someone like Nayib Bukele, let alone having the limelight or the spotlight in the White House, I mean, he should not be taken seriously. But he has become effectively a hero in front of the MAGA people. You know, President Trump has put him on a pedestal. And, you know, these are the people that President Trump welcomes and treats with decency, compared to people like Zelensky, who are supposedly his allies, or any European leader for that matter. They don't get this treatment, but this moron from El Salvador gets the royal treatment. And that is, I think, in my opinion, Donald Trump's way of saying, well, you know, you behave like this guy, and then, you know, you'll get my respect, and you will get the royal treatment, and, you know, you'll have no problems as long as you agree with me. This is what autocrats do, and there's just no other way of describing it. Coming to your original question, Adam, I think it's just going to get worse and worse. And I don't think there's anything that can stop him from here on, from the point of view of, you know, politically or anything like that. You've got Steve Bannon, who appeared on a number of shows during the weekend, openly talking about planning a third term. So wherever it goes, it's some very ugly days, very dark days, I think, awaiting our friends in the US.
Well, as the tariff war continues between the US and China, another Chinese-owned company has been the spotlight in the UK when MPs were called back from their Easter holidays to debate some unprecedented legislation, I guess you could call it, in what was an extremely rare sitting of both houses of parliament on the weekend. Rodney, take us through what's happening. What am I referring to? And is the UK government really saving British steel?
So what they've done is they've taken control of some of the operations to ensure that they could continue to import the raw materials to keep the blast furnaces, I was going to say rolling, but firing or smoking or whatever steel furnaces do. And who would have thought the great days of British steel being more like something of empire rather than the current status of the UK and Britain. But yeah, they decided to take that action over the weekend. It does sound slightly unprecedented because this is a recall of Parliament that was, again, that's rare in itself. It's rare for it to sit over the weekend. But of course, we're moving into the Easter recess. So it's really to get it out of the way at the outset. But yes, it's a step towards nationalisation. It's something that doesn't make money as a commercial entity. It makes losses with some level of consistency. But it's an endeavour by Britain, driven by other external factors, to ensure that it has a level of internal or indigenous steel production to service potential future demand. I mean, when it comes to railway construction or other infrastructure projects, British Steel is more expensive, so it drives up costs. So that's obviously going to have a knock on with other large infrastructure projects. But it's the desire to ensure that in order to have access to steel, that Britain isn't wholly reliant on importing. And given the way the world is moving in terms of free trade and so on, that probably is reasonably sensible, and that's how it's been received within the country. I think it's only 25% of British steel or British steel requirements is met by indigenous production anyway, which is lower than other parts of Europe. And of course, with a mind on future elections, there's 2,700 people employed in this industry, concentrated in areas where the current Labour Party would want to continue to win votes in the future elections. So there's a political aspect, there's a national security, I guess, aspect in terms of the need to be able to produce stuff. They've taken these unprecedented steps, and we'll see what moves next. At some point, the further down this process they go, this has to appear on the balance sheet and has then a bigger impact on government funding, debt, etc.
Well, that's the latest with what's happening in Britain. But just coming back to the US for 1 second, and you mentioned the Ukrainian President Ozan and the treatment that he had when he was in the US versus, you know, his counterpart in El Salvador in the Oval Office over the last sort of 24 hours. There's been a massive Russian attack in Ukraine that's killed at least 35 people, injured hundreds of others, and that this was, you know, really an act of aggression from Russia, I guess the next chapter, the next offensive, whatever you want to call it. But, I mean, does this signal that Ukraine has sort of fallen off the radar when it comes to, you know, what's top of mind for Trump? And didn't he say that he was going to resolve the Ukraine war in 24 hours? I mean, surely the facts here are disagreeing with that sort of rhetoric, right?
Yeah, look, what's happened over the weekend is absolutely horrible. The Russians fired a missile on Palm Sunday in the Ukrainian city of Sumy. This is on the back of a number of missiles that were fired last week, actually in one of President Zelensky's, in his hometown, one of them hit and killed a number of children. But this particular one in the city of Sumy, as you mentioned, has killed about 34 people. And yeah, look, I mean, it doesn't look like it's been resolved. It was going to be resolved in 24 hours. I think it's certainly fallen off the agenda a little bit, but there is no indication whatsoever that there is any sight or any kind of agreement or a ceasefire in sight. And, you know, again, just comes down to the type of politics that President Trump plays with this sort of stuff. He got what he wanted out of it. He got headlines. Talked big about getting President Putin to agree on a ceasefire, etc. And effectively, there was some agreement a couple of weeks ago to ensure that neither side bombed like energy infrastructure or something, and that was broken, I think, about 48 hours later by Putin, who ended up bombing one of the energy sites in Ukraine. It's just a disaster, and it's going to continue like this because you have a very, kind of committed Europe. I think one of the miscalculations on behalf of the Trump administration was that Europe would fold and, you know, with enough pressure, Ukraine would find itself without too many friends. But effectively, the opposite has happened. Countries like Canada, Australia, and many other countries from around the world have expressed their solidarity with Ukraine. Europe has given significant military and financial aid for Ukraine to continue defending itself. And you know, President Trump's a little bit stuck on this, it's the cracks are starting to show in the US's ability to drive the agenda on the international stage, and I think this is the first crack, because you know, if the Trump administration had the power that it claims to have, to be able to solve this problem, we would be much further down the path. But, you know, he hasn't got the Europeans on side. In fact, put them very much offside, which has effectively meant that Europe said, okay, well, we're going to get back Ukraine. You know, and that's obviously frustrating President Putin, who was hoping for Trump to be able to come to some sort of resolution where Putin would end up getting a lot of the things that he wanted. But that's not eventuating. It's a major policy failure in the first 3 months of the Trump administration. And he's really going to have to start thinking about how he can bring it back and get people back to the table so that they can start negotiating some sort of outcome that is you know, going to satisfy both parties. And that's certainly not what Putin had in mind, I'm sure, when President Trump was elected.
Yeah, I wonder whether they're starting to be outplayed on Ukraine, the Americans, and to an extent, the Russians. I mean, and now it seems that Zelensky's inviting Trump to come and assess the damage, which is something that then requires some sort of thought process and potential response from the US administration. And it shouldn't make a difference whether it happened on Palm Sunday or the other Sunday, but if that happened on Palm Sunday, it's obviously significant in the Christian calendar. It's got the evangelicals in America, which of course form a reasonable component of the Republican base, quite animated. So it does feel like one, things are starting to move without the Americans in terms of image, as if they don't have much control to say over the situation. Trump's damaged goods, you know, the stuff around saying it was a mistake, an accident or something for that particular incident, was apologizing for the Russians before the Russians even got to explain, and all damaging. But it feels like Zelensky seems to be from down and out a couple of weeks ago to I suppose as expected, given the way that he just keeps going throughout this entire conflict. He's still out there, he's still playing the game, he's still you know, maneuvering the Americans. And the issue, I guess, is whether it eventually translates into future military or financial support, which is of course essential still for Ukraine from required from many quarters. But it does feel like the idea of the Americans pulling the plug on Ukrainian lights going out in terms of this conflict, that's definitely yesterday's news. We're in a new phase. Maybe it's the sequel of Another 48 Hours, Eddie Murphy.
I mean, when you're busy tanking the world economy, certain things need to be put in the too hard basket, I suppose, and this is one of the things that's in the too hard basket for now. Way too busy trying to tank the global economy.
Yeah, no, I think Ozan, you're right. You can't talk up too many things at the same time because it requires a level of concentration. But
and competence.
Yeah, I'm confident, but I do have a sense that there's a little bit of hope still from Ukraine. I know they were talking about the difficulties they've had in expanding recruitment to 18 to 24 year olds. I think that there was a low uptake in terms of sign-ups militarily in Ukraine, so there's still a shortage of manpower. It does feel like we're in the another phase. They're still at it, and maybe not all isn't lost for Ukraine, which would, given the measurable sacrifice that they've made as a people in the past few years, it would be nice to see that when things do finally come to a conclusion, that sacrifice hasn't been without doing for them, or without at least protection of their event being solved. Even if it's not all of the land that Ukraine had at the initial stages prior to their war.
Well, a lot to digest this week, as always, gents. Thank you so much for your time. See you next week.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch. Thanks for listening.